We've had a long yet productive and fruitful day here at Capital Link. Thank you, Nicholas, for having us for the shipping panel. So shipping is obviously very important to the Greece economy, the country of Greece being the largest ship-owning country with over 300 million deadweight tonnage, second being Japan with only about 200 million. So Greece is obviously a big mover and shaker in the shipping industry, and we have a very distinguished panel for you today of shipping executives from all three of the major shipping markets, tankers, dry bulk commodities, and container shipping. So to my immediate left, we have Harris Komatos, head of strategy and business development of Tsakos Energy and Navigation. To his immediate left, we have Hamish Norton, president of Star Bulk Carriers. And to his immediate left, we have Fotis Giannakoulis, leading analyst from Morgan Stanley. And to his left, we have Nicholas Notias, from CEO of Steelships. And then to his left, we have Bob Burke, CEO of Ridgebury Tankers. And to his left, we have Tasos Asidias, CFO of Eurosea. So we've got a very diverse panel, and hopefully we'll be able to flush out some very interesting perspectives. What I'd like to start out with first is go through some of the major markets, because I think it's very important, given the theme of today being the timing is right for investing in Greece. Let's explore whether the timing is right in certain of these key shipping markets. So I'd like to start out with our tanker executives. Harris, perhaps you can comment on sort of how you see the supply and demand for vessels.
Thanks. Does this work?
Yes.
Okay. I'm used to seeing the red light, but okay. So I'll try and give my two cents on the tanker market. Our company, for those of you that do not know, Tsakos Energy Navigation, a company that was established back in 1993 with four vessels, and today it operates and owns a fleet of 65 vessels, primarily on the crude tanker sector. We are quite optimistic looking forward, particularly as we enter 2018. We went through a soft year, not so much driven by demand, but as always the case, or as in most cases as the case is in tankers, unfortunately driven by supply. However, the irony here is that even though in the past, for example, in the depression years of 2011, 12, 13, in a period of increase in global oil demand, we suffered one of our worst periods in history, primarily because of an overbuilding. About 25% of the fleet at the time was being built in yards in Asia. This time is a little bit different. However, the irony is that we went through an oversupply situation in a period when we are going through one of the smallest order books in recent memory. I mentioned 25% back in 2011. Today we're looking at around 10%. The problem this time around is that the majority of these vessels started coming in and joining the competitive fleet in a narrow time frame. So you had many vessels coming in and kind of disturbing the equilibrium. This we are seeing diminishing today. We believe that, from that 10% of the order book, approximately 50%, half of that will deliver, we expect, by the first half of 2018. So once we get this out of the way, we are looking at least a two-year runway of a very good market, assuming, of course, that global oil demand will be there, and we see no reason why it will not be there. So once the supply side of the equation kind of gets out of the way, we you know, we're very optimistic on the demand side. As I said, you know, things are looking rosy. The India, China and India are the locomotives, primarily China, that is driving the market, especially with you know, the teapot refineries getting new quotas to import oil, which are almost 50% higher than what they were last year, at 142 million tons of oil that will need to be imported from faraway places. It's you know, we are as I keep saying, it's as if the airplane is on the runway and taxiing for takeoff. So things are looking you know, on the positive side. Obviously, you have to take a longer term view, as one has to do in shipping. And don't forget, you know, people get kind of distracted by the OPEC cuts. The OPEC cuts, in a way, are a nuisance. We don't see that impacting long-term the industry. And if anything, the oil that has come out from the market from those cuts is being replenished by new oil from this country. This country is reaching approximately 1 million barrels of exports. Half of that goes to Asia. Very long way routes. It takes capacity out of the market. We will be seeing, you know, maintenance in Middle Eastern refineries. So that will create a mini boost in crude exports in early 2018. So things are shaping up for a very positive, at least a couple of years in crude tankers.
Excellent. So Bob, given what Harris just laid out for us. One of the things that I'm sort of concerned about is the OPEC production cuts and their continued adherence to cutting inventories and production going into 2018. Does that present a concern for you, or if you can comment on that, that would be very helpful.
Yeah, first of all, my name is Robert Patrick Burke, and I'm wondering why I'm at a Greek conference, but then I realized that I have a cousin who's half Greek. And actually, she's a third cousin. And she's actually just dating a Greek guy, so I guess that's why they invited me. You know, the OPEC cuts are certainly an influence on the market. And I won't get into all the ton-mile demand stuff because it's rather boring. But, you know, more oil's come out of the U.S. Gulf, which is farther from China and the Far East than the AG is. So that helps to a certain degree. But I think the biggest thing is, that's going to drive our market is the unwinding of storage, and there was a lot of storage over the past year or so that built up, and it's starting to right itself, and that's killed our market. And number two, scrap. Scrap is, you know, $450 a ton, and as that inches up, and the market is terrible right now, you know, I think the market will right itself. I, as opposed to Harris, I don't think the supply situation will ever right itself. It never does. What happens, I think, in most of the markets is something unforeseen. Scrap goes through the roof, or, you know, there's a problem geopolitically somewhere, or some unforeseen event happens in China on the supply-demand side that drives all of our markets.
Great. Let's move on to the dry bulk market. Nicholas, maybe you can lay out for us sort of the dynamics in that market in terms of supply and demand for ships.
It's picking up on what Robert just said, actually. There are things that happen in the market that always change and make the markets fun and makes the markets go up and down. And it's not always the statistics that we sit in our rooms or have our analysts and researchers comprise. A year ago, I was at the Norwegian Hellenic Greek Forum, and I remember the question that was being posed to us was, will we see ships being laid up like we did in the 80s? And quite frankly, I looked at the audience then, and I really want to say, no, we will not, with a lot of vigor and firm, and say, no, the market will not be there. We'll see probably the market double in value by next year. Like most people, I didn't go that far out, but I did turn around and voice that moment in time that I think that the market will probably see itself develop slowly, gradually to the break-even levels as we come out of the holidays, work our way to a little bit above break-even. And for that reason, you will not see ships go to the breakers. But more importantly was, what was happening in China? All right, and why was the market depressed last year? All right, and was there an oversupply of vessels? Sure there was. But in my view, it was really a deficiency of cargoes. We built these ships because we expected demand to be there, and demand just vanished. It disappeared. Well, crisis happened. That was one reason. Of course, major reason was that the fact that in China we had the renewable energies, we had coal being displaced, we had the bauxite stop, and we had 250 Supermaxes displaced in the Southeast Asia, and you saw ships competing for each other, for the business, that is. And today, where we stand, from last year to this year, we had scrap values high enough that people sent the older ships to the breakers, so we took a lot of tonnage out of the market. That helped, obviously. Banks were not loaning money, so people were not putting in new buildings. That helped tremendously. And today, we have a demand across the board that shows firmness. It's helping everything move up north. We think 2018 and 2019 are promising years. The new regulations set out for 2020 and so forth should also make things better for the dry bulk market, with the older vessels having to be scrapped because it doesn't make sense to retrofit them for the scrubbers. So there are very positive signs, but we also have some very scary signs out there as well. We have global debt that we have to be concerned about. China can change things overnight, and we can be right back where we started from, not to the deep droughts, but certainly lower levels. So one last comment, and that is, what do we think the market's headed for the next year? We think we'll be on firmer ground than we were this year, and I think we have at least next 2 years to look promising.
Excellent. So dry bulk poised to for recovery. Hamish, is China, what is your view of China and the impact on the dry bulk market? Nicholas laid out for us sort of the dynamics there in terms of the risk. How do you sort of see things from that perspective?
Well, I don't disagree that there are risks in dry bulk, but we're pretty optimistic and basically agree with what Nick said. We expect the dry bulk fleet to grow next year by 2.5% net of scrapping. And we see ton-mile demand increasing likely by more than that, by order of 4%. And much of that is due to China, due to our anticipation of increased demand for imported iron ore and imported coal in China. And, there are a few reasons for that. One is that Chinese steel consumption seems to be rising. We think that's being driven in part by the One Belt, One Road, or whatever they're calling it nowadays.
One Belt, One Road.
initiative, which is consuming a lot of steel. But also, China is shutting down some of their inefficient steelmaking capacity, which some of it uses domestic Chinese iron ore, which is very poor quality and somewhat more polluting and making steel out of higher quality imported ore. And they're also shutting down a lot of domestic coal mining and importing apparently higher quality coal from outside. So the move to reduce air pollution combined with the continuing demand for steel, we think is very favorable toward imports. So we're optimistic, barring a financial crisis or a Korean War or something, horrible and unforeseen.
Great. Appreciate that. So let's round this out with Tasos Asilias, who I'll ask to comment on the container shipping market. Now, China, Asia region, the main lane trade route between Asia to Europe has been quite challenged with supply and demand. Maybe you can comment on the landscape of the container shipping and containerized volume growth for next year.
Thank you, Mike. Indeed, the container ship market has been since 2011 in a very long recession, with the exception of a few months in 2015, that rates were good. It's been a long period of miserable rates. It seems that this year has been, to some extent, a turning point for the following reasons. There is, for one thing, the order book at a pretty low level compared to the recent history. We're down to the low teens, and it used to be up in the 60% range a few years back. So the prospects of low supply growth over the next couple of years are much better. And secondly, this year we observed the first synchronized recovery of the major economies of the world, Europe, Japan, US, which bolstered demand for finished goods, and this is really the driver for the container ship market. So, and if Europe does well, then a lot of containers are being transported from mainly Asia to Europe, and that's a long distance that they have to travel, so that has a multiplier effect of the demand. So very fundamentally, the synchronized recovery of the developed world and generally of the world economy and the relatively low prospects for supply growth is what shape the outlook in the medium term, in the near and medium term.
Much appreciated. So let's transition to sort of another topic. But before we do, I want to introduce again Fotis Giannakoulis, who's a shipping analyst at Morgan Stanley. And Fotis, you've sort of heard sort of the landscape from our key executives here. What do you see as from your dialogue with the investor base in terms of how they view the markets going into 2018, and also whether it reconciles with your view as well?
I think that the views that they were described earlier is overall the consensus among investors. But I think what is more interesting and what occupies investors' mind is a little bit longer term what is going to happen. Everybody has the view about crude tanker market probably is going to stay weak for at least another year. Dry bulk will continue to be good for at least another year. Container ships are in the path of a recovery. We all know that all these sectors are extremely volatile. And as Tassos said, the container ship sector managed to go through a very long period of weakness, and despite that, the industry and shipping and especially Greek shipping has managed to stay alive and managed to prosper and even take advantage of these weak markets. It manages to expand and contract without leaving, without staying behind, and maintaining its leading position around the world. This is a lesson that I think for the Greek economy that we can take from the success of Greek shipping. I think most of the concern right now for investors is what is going to happen long term. A lot of people have started wondering, is there a need for tankers? Not right now, but what is going to happen in 10 years? Is a company that is going to buy a tanker today that it has a useful life of 25 years is going to have a viable business in 10 years? And this is the most difficult part. And the same thing applies for dry bulk. China this year is growing strongly. Steel demand is growing at a very nice pace. Imports are increasing, iron ore imports, by more than 6%. Near term, everything looks great, but what happens in 2020?
Fotis, why wouldn't a tanker business be viable in 10 years? What will happen?
I don't have the answer.
You mean they think tankers will disappear
No, I'm not saying that they disappear, but I'm saying that the concern, and I'm not sharing this concern necessarily, is that whether we are going to be in a growing industry or in a shrinking industry. If you have a 1% growth, it's very, very different than having 1% negative growth, which means that you need to cut investment significantly, and you need to chase a falling knife. I think that's why we have seen this year, and I'm not sharing this negative attitude, but investors, they do have a negative attitude, and they are chasing the market. What I was pointing out today about Hamish's company is that the market has doubled since April, and the stock of Star Bulk has been down by 20%. For me, this is an opportunity, but you see that a lot of investors are afraid of putting a high multiple, whether it is in a tanker stock or even a dry bulk stock that is booming right now.
Interesting. You brought up an interesting point on aged ships, and I want to get into sort of asset class investing with our key executives here, and want to pick their brains on within their market, as they see the different classes of ships and ages, what stands out as compelling given where they are and their views of not only 2018, but the evolving balancing or rebalancing of supply and demand. So let's start with Bob Burke, if you can, on sort of how he sees things in the tanker space.
Sure. I just realized why I was invited here. We just closed on 4 16-year-old VLCCs, which is the Greek model. Buy older tonnage right before the market goes up. And if you buy ships, the way I look at shipping is it's a continuous option in a transportation market. And the best ships to buy are the older ships right before the market takes off. Of course, we can't call an up market. But the ones we bought are 120% of scrap value. And we have 4 years to make that 20% back. Of course, scrap can always fall. But the strategy was you're buying the volatility of the VL market for a small margin over scrap, or basically your cost of capital. And I like that strategy on most asset classes, as opposed to buying a new asset, which is it's a whole different strategy. I mean, you don't get the same margins on the older assets, but you get darn close, and your capital cost is significantly less, and your exit strategy is a lot easier. The other thing I find is, I think Fotis is right, investors are worried about the long term, they should be, but they're also worried about liquidity in this market. And if you buy older assets and your exit strategy is through cash flow and you don't lever them or lever them very, very low, you can pay cash out on a regular basis, and the exit strategy is run the ship until it's time to scrap her.
Excellent. Harris, would you like to add to what Bob just said about his investment strategy?
Well, I guess in the end, it all boils down to a company's operational model and then owners, if you like, a risk appetite or a risk profile. In this day and age, in this market, financially, return-wise, perhaps, and especially if you're adopting a shorter-term outlook, investing in older vessels perhaps makes more sense return-wise. But in the end of the day, we're not in this industry chasing every single dollar out of the market. We're offering a service, and sometimes it's better to leave some dollars on the table as long as you make sure you safeguard the survivability of the company and its long-term prospects. And this is the model that we have adopted, the industrial model in shipping. We are, focusing more on the modern tonnage, longer-term contracts, and knowing that short-term, perhaps if we had invested that money in older vessels in the spot market, we would have made bigger returns, but we would rather have an annuity-like of return to our investors and safeguard and provide visibility and safeguard the dividend policy of the company. That should be another model for investors to consider. I'm not saying the model that Bob is adopting is wrong. If anything, it has proved to be probably the right model at this very moment. But one has to take a different approach on how to set up the company for the long run. And this is how TEN is set up, more of an industrial play, catering to the needs of the big oil majors, and to the question on the asset play, again, because we like to be the carriers of choice of the big majors, we do not pick the asset class in a way. We listen to the needs of our clients, like the case in point of the Statoil deal. It was Statoil that came to us and offered contracts against Aframax vessels, and we ended up building 9 for them. If they wanted Suezmaxes, we would have built Suezmaxes. So our investment philosophy, in a way, and to a large extent, is guided by the needs of our clients, the long-term needs of our clients.
Great. And Hamish, given the optimism in the dry bulk market? How do you sort of see the opportunities either in the asset class or the age profile of ships?
Well, I mean, we certainly see opportunities. We're not at the moment, you know, buying any significant number of ships for cash, as we tell anybody who cares to listen to us. Our strategy is to go into the next inevitable dry bulk downturn, whenever that might occur, as close to debt-free as we can get, because, of course, in the downturn is the time when it's really profitable to buy dry bulk ships, and we want to be in a position to do that. You know, that being said, I think, you know, we're probably in a situation where the market is headed up, and particularly probably headed up in 2020 with the environmental regulations taking hold. So I think the Bob Burke strategy of buying old ships and milking them for whatever they're worth is probably a good one. You know, especially since it may be just as expensive to outfit a new ship that's bought today for future environmental regulations as, you know, an old ship, and maybe the right thing to do is to order a new ship when the IMO and the EU figure out what they're going to put in place as environmental regulations. You know, the order book in Capes is the largest in the dry bulk business. There may be enough Capes already in the world. You know, the order book for Kamsarmax, Panamax class, and Supermax, Ultramax class ships is significantly smaller, and the need for those ships isn't going away.
Nicholas, given what Hamish said about sort of the different asset classes and the order book rundown there, where do you see sort of the opportunities in dry bulk as you kind of look ahead into 2018?
Well, I think there are opportunities across the board. We're not into the big ships. We don't play the Capes or the Kamsarmaxes or the Post-Panamaxes, so that's an area that we don't get involved in. For us, we stay on the Handymax to Supermax level, maybe a Panamax, you know, and I believe very much in relationships and cargoes. So similar to what Harry was saying earlier, you know, we don't necessarily go out and build ships for our clients' needs because we don't have that kind of relationship that makes sense to do that. But what we do is, for example, if we have a major client like Sims Group, which is our scrap client, you know, we have the older ladies for that business because we can load scrap and, you know, and not be concerned about the stevedore damage and the wear and tear on the vessel, and we can maximize our value, low capital, we get above market freights, and it works out perfect for us. And we can offload the vessel at the right time for scrap value and made a good return. You know, I think in this market, though, what we're looking to do is actually pick up some younger ships, and at the same time go into the contracts with our friends. So if we buy an Ultramax, for example, we also take on a contract, so we kind of hedge ourselves a little bit.
Interesting. And Tassos, can you talk to us about the container shipping asset classes and what seems compelling to you?
Sure. As I mentioned earlier, the container ship market is amongst the three that we're discussing is at an earlier stage of its recovery. So naturally, one would expect that prices pretty much across the board to be at more attractive levels. My company is primarily focused on the smaller container ships, what we call feeder ships, but even medium-sized container ships. And there, in addition to the recovery of the cycle, you have also to deal with sort of redefinition of the role of various ships in the trade. There was a new Panama Canal, more expanded, so that reshuffles a little bit the trade lanes. So in addition to the price of the ship, one has to pay attention to the commercial attractiveness of the ship. So the ship itself is a big factor when we look at container ship investments. If you look at the range of ships, of container ships, from smaller feeders to medium size, one will notice that for the feeder ships, the supply is actually expected to decline, is projected to decline over the next year. So one would expect a little better supply-demand dynamics, maybe for the feeder ships and the medium size. So we're focusing and finding attractive candidates, good vessels, and what we believe is still attractive prices to enter, to continue investing in the sector.
Excellent. So we've laid out sort of everyone's view on sort of what they're thinking in terms of 2018 supply and demand for vessels, which is critical for setting the stage for charter rates and asset values. We've also picked the brains of the executives in terms of what they see in terms of compelling investment opportunities. What I'd like to now transition to is to go and discuss one key major risk on the top of your minds that kind of keep you up at night, if you will. And I like to start with FOTUS, the investment analyst from the investor community. What kind of dialogues are keeping investors up at night for shipping?
One thing that I'm going to put on the side is always over-optimism among ship owners and oversupply. But I think that the main thing is commodity prices. The fact that the dry bulk market is doing so much better today is because Chinese steel mills, they are doing much better. Steel prices are much higher because of the reasons that Hamish explained earlier. One of the reasons why oil tankers are doing so poorly today is exactly because we still have a weak oil market. We still have very high inventories, and these inventories, they have to come down even further. And what I think that these markets are transitioning increasingly is towards relationships, as Harris mentioned, as Nicholas mentions. I'm sure that Tassos will say the same for his company's relationship with his company, with his customers. Bob is playing a little bit different game, a little bit shorter term game. I think that the way that these markets work right now is that you need relations. You need the volatility to make money, and you need the relationships to stay afloat. If you manage to have both, this is how the game can be played successfully.
Great. And Tassos, what is keeping you up at night, and as you manage your books at Euroseas?
I think, frankly, the risk that is always a risk in shipping is overordering by far. I think industry has been shooting itself on the foot time after time, and ship owners tend to order in waves, and that's really the big risk that we're afraid of.
I see, over-ordering. And Harris, what say you?
No, probably I concur with my colleagues here. The obviously, over-ordering is what has historically been the major risk in the tanker sector, providing very healthy returns. And even though we're not seeing signs of this today, there are some glimpses that owners sometimes get overexcited and they order at en masse. This could potentially be a risk, but don't forget that it takes a couple of years to build a vessel, so it's not an immediate risk. Even if everybody goes in this room and orders 10 VLs tomorrow, they will not get them before 2 years. But it's something that we should always be mindful of and avoid to build speculatively. And we as a company have been very good at that. The CEO of the company, Nick Tsakos, as a chairman of Intertanko, he's preaching the gospel, basically trying to make owners cognizant of the fact that if they overorder, they're going to shoot themselves on the foot. That tied with commodity prices, obviously the price of oil has positives and negatives. Unfortunately, you know, as the prices collapsed from the $110 down to the $30-$20 that we saw, you know, a year or so ago, 2 years ago, and the oil tanker company stocks crashed because of their association to the greater energy sector, even though investors totally failed to see that the tanker sector was a natural hedge, during that period, the market really went through the roof, and we had one of our best periods in recent memory. But unfortunately, that didn't translate into prices that reflected, you know, that side of the market. We have seen historically that for demand to have some kind of demand destruction, oil prices should be more, you know, north of I would say $80-$90. I don't see this thing happening, but it's a risk. If we see that, then potentially we could see a deceleration in global oil demand. The OPEC cuts don't really keep me up at night. I think they are nullified by the additional oil of the U.S. and the countries exempt from the cuts, like Libya, Iran, and Nigeria. They are filling the void. They are not creating such an imbalance. I think. It's totally controllable.
I see. And Bob, anything company specific that would consider a risk going into?
I'm not going to repeat everything everyone else said because I agree with it. You know, we own 24 ships, and a lot of them are, most of them are, they're all newer than the ones we just bought. But you know, in shipping, we're all in the volatility game, and the volatility is driven by unknown. I mean, everything else is priced in. The order book, the supply, the demand, the ton miles, all that stuff is priced in. So what keeps me awake when the market is really good is the volatility to the downside and what we don't know, what's going to drive it down that we don't know, what's the unforeseen. I don't mind staying awake worrying about that. Now I stay awake because I'm worrying when that volatility to the upside is going to come. And, you know, without a doubt, it's driven by the unknown somewhere. And at this point in our market, the tanker market, there's a lot more upside than downside. And we just took a big bet that that upside will come in the next few years.
Hamish, what say you on what keeps you up at night?
Well, I'm going to mention something that others have mentioned obliquely. You know, the IMO low sulfur regulations in 2020 are probably the best thing that could possibly happen to dry bulk shipping, because dry bulk ships will have to stop burning cheap high sulfur residual fuel oil and have to start burning expensive low sulfur marine gas oil. And it's a little known fact, but charter rates, all things being equal, are approximately proportional to fuel prices, because the fleet will tend to want to slow down, and that basically is almost the same as having fewer dry bulk ships. So, frankly, the thing that keeps me up at night is whether the IMO will be under political pressure that it will give into to delay the low sulfur fuel regulation or phase it in over time. I don't think that will happen. I think that it will come in overnight on January 1, 2020. But if it doesn't, that would be very bad for the dry bulk business, because, you know, otherwise it's going to be very good.
Applies for tankers and other asset classes as well, not only.
It does in the sense that, all things being equal, high fuel prices are good for tankers, but with tankers, all things are unlikely to be equal.
Yeah.
Because tankers are influenced by the fuel price as well. For container ships, it is a little different if you're a container line, because if you're a container line, you pay for your own fuel, and you want that to be cheap. So, I mean, it affects the different asset classes a little bit differently.
And for the tankers, it'll create arbitrage opportunities.
Yeah.
Interesting. And Nicholas, how do you feel about the IMO regulations and anything specific to steel ships that keeps you up at night as we go into a positive dry bulk market?
Honestly, nothing keeps me up at night.
I think that's good.
No, truthfully, I think this volatility gives you opportunities. Good markets, bad markets, is opportunities. A concern that I have, of course, is China, right? Demand coming off, whether it's because of commodity prices or because of the shift in policy. Right? I'm concerned about that. That will bring the asset prices down. It will bring down the freight levels and our profitability. So that's a concern. What my goal is, something that Hamish pointed out, I think, earlier, and that is having a good balance sheet to take advantage of another down cycle. I think a lot of us, to be quite blunt about it, we got blinded last year. It was a very bad market. Liquidity was an issue from the smallest of owners to the biggest of owners. So I think that's a lesson we all learned as executives of companies. So that's a concern. And as far as regulations are concerned, we are looking at steelships to acquire new vessels. We just picked up a two-year-old Ultramax, and the reason for that was price, good spec vessel, and a long life ahead of it. But I would equally go out and buy an older vessel today, right, without as much concern about the regulation if I thought I could write it down to scrap value in short order.
Great, great. Given that we are what separates you guys from cocktails, I'm going to, unless there are questions in the audience, we can field a couple of questions. Otherwise, I want to thank the panelists and for a great discussion, and thank you all for attending.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice meeting you.